From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. On this week's show, we remember legendary funk diva Marva Whitney.
Then he says, Mr. Brown would like to see you. Oh, was I afraid?
Area farmers are still waiting for Congress to pass a new farm bill.
We'd just like to know whether it's good or bad for us, but the uncertainty of it is the part that we don't like.
And a brand new virus has surfaced near St. Joseph.
If it never happened, it'd all been, you know, for the better, I think.
Plus, just outside of St. Joe, chanting nuns make a hit record.
Basically, their life is one big song. I mean, I say this all the time, but I think really they must sing more than they actually speak.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. Iconic funk and soul singer Marva Whitney was remembered at a funeral service this weekend at Memorial Missionary Baptist Church in southeast Kansas City. She died 2 weeks ago at the age of 68. That was just 6 years after the passing of James Brown, who catapulted her from KCK to national stardom. In recent years, Whitney had made a comeback, performing all over Europe and Japan, but not here in Kansas City. Sylvia has this remembrance of Soul Sister Number One.
Kansas City, Kansas native Marva Whitney became known in the 1960s for her soaring vocals and diva style. Her friend and advisor Dwayne Gillies says she was one of the first women to embody the authority of funk.
You knew there was a sense of urgency. She's going to grab you by the throat.
Unwind yourself.
No prisoners. With the kick and the drive of the bass, with the fine little funk guitar lines, the horn section hitting you, and then Marva sailing over the entire bit of it.
Whitney was tiny and glamorous, often sporting an afro and an attitude that matched her big voice. She may have made her name in funk, but the young Marva Ann Manning was from a church family. She told the Fish Fry's Chuck Haddix in 2007 that her grandparents founded a church in Armordale, and her mother was, and still is today, a gifted musician.
Mother seemed to be the anointed one. My grandmother anointed her fingers, and boy, she picked the right one. Well, as we got to be children, before my grandmother died, she says, those children are going to sing. Now, I had been singing in church since I was about 3 because that's what they do to keep the children busy. So mother, she started practicing with us. It took her about a year for us to understand harmony. And she almost gave up several times, but we didn't.
Marva and her 6 brothers, including a set of triplets and a set of twins, were the Manning Gospel Singers. They performed throughout the region and were even featured in Ebony magazine. Marva later joined the acclaimed Whitney Singers and married into the family.
When I was with the Whitney Singers, I was the high first soprano. And there was one time I hit a note. It must have been just right. And it was a glass on the table and it broke. And they all looked at me. They said, Marva, you broke the glass.
Whitney brought her effortlessly piercing soprano to popular music with the local band Tommy and the Derbies. They opened for many of the big names coming through Kansas City. And when James Brown played Memorial Hall in 1967, Whitney said she was asked to stay late. A member of the band told her to sing into a little recorder.
He said, stay right here. He went into Mr. Brown's room. Okay, and then he says, Mr. Brown would like to see you. Oh, was I afraid? I walked in there, and he says, "Hello." He's nice but very stern at when he's into his business. And he tells me, he says, you sound pretty good.
Marva Whitney's next 2 years with the James Brown Review sounded like a dream come true and a bit of a nightmare. She said he was a musical genius, a shrewd businessman, and a tyrant. But it was James Brown who had the idea behind her biggest solo hit. It's my thing. I can do what I want to do.
The Isley Brothers was on James' back. I mean, everywhere he turned, he heard, "It's your thing, do what you want to do." It was so hot, it was upsetting Mr. Brown. And he said, "Whit?" He said, "We got to do something about that." He said, "You're going to say it's your thing." He said, "Right, it's my thing." I said to myself, "How can I write 'it's my thing'?" And so I just kind of turned the words around, you know, and he had the music in his head. And he liked it. He liked it. So he had a friend in San Francisco. In those days, whatever Mr. Brown wanted, Mr. Brown was making so much money for the company, they dare not say no. He put that dub of that session on the plane. He said, "It'll be there in about 2 hours." He said, "And I want you to put it on the air and let me know what kind of response do you get." They loved it. Phones start ringing off the hook. He said, "Mm-hmm. I thought so." He picks up the phone. He calls King Records and he says, "Stop the presses. Press Marva Whitney's It's My Thing." And they stopped the presses. And you know, they had plenty of good country and Western people that recorded for King. But when Mr. Brown says, "Stop the presses and press what he said," that's exactly what happened.
Whitney had her own segment in the show and sang some legendary duets with James Brown at the Apollo Theater in Harlem and in Boston the night after the shooting of Martin Luther King Jr. She recorded 3 solo albums on his label. One of them, a record of jazz standards, has never been released. Now, Whitney and other band members say they never received their fair share of revenue from shows and record sales. She told Chuck Haddix that JB's leadership style was military all the way.
"I got a $75 fine for having a wrinkle in the back of my dress. Now, who was going to see that? I mean, if you weren't there at 6 o'clock, you got fined, and he would take your money that week. And it could be really hard. And you talk about the bus. I would be glad to ride the bus because to ride on his plane was not the best thing that you wanted to do because James never went to sleep until daybreak. And all of us had to sit there and talk with the boss. And now it's daybreak. He's ready to go to bed. But I've got to get up at 8 o'clock. To get myself ready, to make sure the clothes are ready, to make sure that we're ready in case whatever he wants, all of the entourage is behind him, right? I was happy to get on the bus."
Whitney said they were both Tauruses, and she tried her best to lay low.
James act like a grandpa, too. you couldn't talk back. And I made the mistake of talking back.
That was just once, and she got sent home for 3 weeks with no pay. Whitney split with Brown in 1969, went on to found the Forte label in Kansas City with her second husband, Ellis Taylor. Daddy Don't Know About Sugar Bear was one of her favorite songs of that era. Forte recordings have become high-dollar collector's items. They're about to be re-released by the Numero label this year. During the funk revival of the past decade, Whitney began performing again, mostly in Europe. That was until her manager played her some music by a band he wanted her to check out.
I said, "Ooh, where did you get that? That sounds like James' first band." I said, "And how did y'all get his James's voice to raise above this?" And he started laughing. I said, "What's funny?" He said, "That's not James Brown." I said, "You're lying." And then he told me, he said, "They're all Japanese, and they're the biggest band in Japan, and they're called Osaka Monorail." In 2006, Whitney ended up recording her last album, I Am What I Am, with Osaka Monorail. That led to tours in Japan and Australia, but she told Chuck Haddocks that she never felt appreciated here in Kansas City.
"I don't understand why I can't, or they won't ask me to play the boats, when all over the world, Russia, every place all over the world, they're wanting me, but I'm at home. And they don't know me, and they don't want to respect what I expect from them. You call me this, you call me that. I met you at the store, I know where it's at. I am. Hey.
A year ago, Marva Whitney suffered a stroke while performing on stage in Australia. She retired from singing and died on December 22nd of complications from pneumonia. This was going to be a big year for Whitney. Besides the re-release of the Forte recordings, she had a book coming out called God, the Devil, and James Brown, Memoirs of a Funky Diva.
I'm brokenhearted about it. I really am.
That was Whitney's friend, Duane Gilley, whom she turned to because of the work he had done boosting the careers of local jazz icons, Pearl Thuston Brown and Myra Taylor. Gilley said the timing has been especially sad because she was about to get a new round of recognition.
But, I guess there's two ways to look at it. Somebody can pass and they're like, "Who was that? Who cares?" Or you can go out on a high where people were caring about you. People wanted something from you. They wanted to work with you. And to the very day she died, she was somebody. And she said, I may have come up poor. I may end up dying poor, but I've got soul about me."
Marva Whitney's funky wail lives on in endless remixes and samples by hip-hop DJs and rappers. But this weekend, she was remembered by her 5 surviving brothers, her mother, her 2 children, and the rest of her musical family here in Kansas City in the genre she never left behind, gospel.
"I'm tired.
I'm weary. But I must toil on. Till the Lord comes to call me.
We're listening to Marva Whitney's recording of the gospel song Peace in the Valley with Osaka Monorail. This remembrance was produced with the help of Chuck Haddix, Laura Ziegler, and Michael Byers.
Where the morning is bright, and the lamb
You're listening to Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Farmers and ranchers across the country expected to start the new year with a new farm bill in place. The legislation sets agricultural policy for the next 5 years.
So last week, House and Senate negotiators worked feverishly to come to a fiscal cliff deal, and word leaked that the Agriculture Committee had finally come to an agreement on the long-awaited farm bill. But the deal merely extended parts of the bill that expired in October, which means there will still be subsidies, but no dairy reform or enough money to pay for relief programs, among other things. We've invited Jeremy Bernfeld of Harvest Public Media to share his reporting with us about the farm bill. Jeremy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So break it down for us. What does an extension mean as opposed to an all-new farm bill?
Yeah, usually the farm bill runs for 5 years. And so that last five-year farm bill expired on September 30th last year, and the farmers have been operating kind of in this gray world without policy ever since. As part of the fiscal cliff deal, Congress ended up just extending parts of that last farm bill for another 9 months, so it'll come up again this September 30th. They kind of picked and choose which programs in the farm bill they wanted to fund. So, you know, they left some things out. And they usually run it for 5 years because farmers make really long-term decisions. So having a five-year policy underpinning that really makes sense.
So how is all this affecting farmers and ranchers in our region?
Well, I think a lot of them are really frustrated with the lack of certainty. You know, as I said, most farmers' decisions, they're going to have ramifications for years to come. And so I think they're a little worried that if they make a bad decision now and Congress comes in with a new farm bill that pulls the policy rug out from underneath their feet, that they could be left worried about the long-term viability of their farm.
We're going to continue to talk with you more about all of this in just a little bit. But first, we're going to hear a piece that you've done. Would you mind setting it up for us?
Yeah, sure. You know, it takes months for crops to grow, so farmers are obviously used to waiting. But a lot of farmers and ranchers are saying that they've just been waiting too long for a comprehensive farm bill, and so now they're fed up with Congress. We're going to start by hearing reactions from one of those farmers.
Not surprised, but disappointed that they couldn't come together on something, and just leaving a lot of people kind of out there on a limb, not knowing what's going on.
That's Alfred Brandt, who runs a dairy farm near Lynn, Missouri. He milks about 150 cows on his pastoral farm just off a gravel road. The farm bill is important to farmers like Brandt because it sets all kinds of subsidy payments, disaster relief programs, and conservation agendas. Farmers can't control much about their business, so they crave certainty about the aspects they can control. Without knowing what agriculture policy will look like next year, it's tough for them to make best practice planting decisions. It's hard for ranchers and dairy producers to decide just how big their herd should be. The farm bill is usually authorized for 5 years, but since Congress couldn't pass a new bill, it merely extended parts of the previous farm bill until the end of September, picking and choosing which programs to fund. That's 9 more months of short-term policy and 9 more months of uncertainty for farmers like Brandt.
We're just kind of left out here on a lurch. We don't really know which way we can turn, so we'd just like to know whether it's good or bad for us, but the uncertainty of it is the part that we don't like.
Extending the farm bill also locks in another round of controversial direct payments. That means billions in government subsidies for some grain, cotton, and soybean farmers, subsidies that even many of them don't think are necessary anymore. And the extension doesn't include funding for disaster aid programs and programs designed to encourage young people to get back into farming. It also doesn't fully fund programs that help support local farmers markets and agricultural research provisions. Ferd Hefner, with the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, says merely extending the current farm bill hurts small local farmers.
The takeaway is that we're going backwards in time, getting rid of the programs that I think the general public and the consumers are demanding. Those are the same programs that are getting terminated.
The extension hit dairy producers especially hard. Many say the safety net for them is outdated, and the new farm bill would have created a program to protect them against higher feed costs. Jerry Kozak heads the National Milk Producers Federation. He says last year's drought significantly raised the cost of feed, and that's chasing some dairy farmers out of business.
Whether it's dairy farming or producing Energizer batteries, no one can produce a product at a loss.
Kozak says dairy farmers looking for a new safety net are out of luck, at least until the extension expires at the end of September.
Of course we're frustrated. And in the interim, as dairy farm families exit the business while we're still debating it, it clearly is going to fall on the heads of those who failed to bring this up for a vote.
So even farmers, long known for their patience, are growing weary of waiting on Congress.
That report was from Harvest Public Media's Jeremy Bernfeld. He's here with us on Casey Currents, talking to us about the extensions added to the fiscal cliff package to avert the dairy cliff. Talk to us a bit more about the buildup to the potential dairy cliff that we've been hearing about. If Congress had failed to come up with something, we could have seen milk prices double, for example, based off of a law from 1949. What's the story there?
Yeah, that was one of the big impetus for making sure that we had at least something as far as an extension of the farm bill or a new farm bill come January 1st. Basically, on January 1st, if there's no superseding law, then a 1949 law, as you mentioned, would kick in. And that would have the government buying milk at a hugely inflated price, which would just drive up the price for consumers. And people were warning that, you know, instead of the $3, $4 gallon of milk that you're used to seeing now, it would be more like $6, $8, $9 gallon of milk. And obviously nobody wanted to see that. So that was a big reason why Congress was trying to get together and make sure that they passed some kind of policy to avert that, what they called the dairy cliff.
So how much are we really on the verge of a dairy cliff in the near future, even with this extension?
Well, I think the extension is for 9 months, and that means that we're looking again at another dairy cliff in 9 months. You know, come October 1st, I don't believe that the milk prices will rise on October 1st, but I think if they don't, I believe the way it works is that if they don't pass another farm bill come January 1st, that we're going to be seeing another dairy cliff. So that's still out there, and it's out there for a reason. It's a lot like the fiscal cliff. Farm state lawmakers wanted to make sure that there was a reason to hustle up a bill when the farm bill expired. And so they're keeping that there in place to make sure that there is that impetus.
One of the things you mentioned before was disaster relief. What options do farmers have now for relief in the case of natural disaster?
Well, there is some disaster relief out there through aid organizations, and the big problem is that the lion's share of disaster aid and the farm safety net comes from the federal government, and that's contained in the Farm Bill. So right now, a lot of the crop producers are fine because they're in their planting season and they're not worried about disaster. But again, especially for livestock producers, they kind of feel like they're in the midst of it right now, or perhaps even in some ways that ship has sailed and they're not getting a lot of help.
What concerns have you heard from farmers if the drought continues into next year?
I think it's just what you'd expect. I think without a farm safety net, a lot of farmers and ranchers are saying that they're going to have to go out of business or find new ways to bring in revenue. And they're worried that that could have effect, you know, that could affect consumers. You could see rising food prices, that kind of thing. So, you know, nothing's set in stone, but certainly there are a lot of really uncomfortable, especially dairy and livestock producers right now, who are really worried.
Well, Jeremy, we want to thank you for joining us here on KC Currents today.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks.
Jeremy Burnfield is reporting for Harvest Public Media and KCUR. You can find out more information on their website at harvestpublicmedia.org.
If you can't listen to all of KC Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. This past year brought some unexpected attention to the St. Joseph area. A team of researchers identified a new virus there. It's believed to be transmitted by ticks. It's the first discovery of a new human virus native to North America in nearly two decades. But as KCUR's Alana Gordon reports, scientists are just beginning to piece together what this means.
Larry Smithers has lived off the beaten path, literally, off of dirt roads for 30 years.
Well, we're probably 17 miles northwest of San Joe.
In Amazonia, Missouri, population about 300. But there's plenty of other creatures out here. Birds, raccoons, and...
You can't go out without getting ticks all over you.
Lots of ticks. Smithers has mostly kept to himself in this wooded 40-acre plot, raising horses and fixing up cars. But back in 2009, his life took an unexpected turn.
This is where I was working at when I got sick.
Smithers points to a wired fence several yards from us in a clearing at the top of a hill.
We probably cut down 50 or 75 big trees across that hill.
It was a few days after being out here, putting up that new fence and getting bitten by ticks, that Smithers started feeling weak. He thought it might be the flu. His regular doctor referred him to Heartland Hospital in St. Joseph for x-rays. When he got there, things went downhill fast.
We started down to admittance, and I could see myself walking down the hallway, and so I went up and put my hands on the hips, you know. I was guiding myself so I wouldn't run into anybody.
So you were really out of it.
Yeah.
Smithers doesn't remember much after that, except he'd never been so sick.
Well, some of the neighbors thought I was going to die. Matter of fact, a couple of times I thought I was too. I didn't know whether I was ever going to come out of it or not.
Hospital staff didn't know what to do either.
Okay.
Dr. Scott Folk, head of infectious diseases at Heartland, does rounds just about every day here, meeting with patients for sometimes upwards of an hour, trying to figure out what's wrong with them. Dr. Folk tells me even he was stumped. Smithers and another patient at that time appeared to have a certain tick-borne disease.
Initially, I thought that, okay, they've been bitten by a tick, it's the summertime, they have fever, low white blood cell count, low platelet counts, certain key laboratory abnormalities. I thought that they both had ehrlichiosis.
Do you see that very much here?
I see about maybe 4 to 10 cases of ehrlichiosis per year here.
Ehrlichiosis is a bacteria transmitted by the Lone Star tick. So Folk prescribed Smithers and the other patient antibiotics. That usually helps, he says, but this time it didn't. Smithers and the other patient remained hospitalized for more than a week.
Made me nervous. It was unsettling. And it was hard to go into the patient's room each day and scratch my head and say, you know, we don't really know what's wrong with you yet. I thought it was ehrlichiosis, but it may not be, and we're still trying to figure out what it is that's wrong with you.
Folk hope the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta might have answers. Missouri's health lab doesn't test for ehrlichiosis, so folks sometimes sends blood samples from patients he thinks have the disease to the CDC for confirmation. There's one guy in particular he's been in touch with for years.
I'm William Nicholson. I'm a research microbiologist at the Centers for Disease Control.
Dr. William Nicholson is specifically interested in tick diseases like ehrlichiosis, so he likes getting samples from folk and other doctors from time to time for research purposes. But Nicholson also didn't know what to make of Smithers' blood sample.
And we were, like, puzzled because we couldn't see anything, but there were changes in the cell that are similar to what we see with Ehrlichia.
Nicholson doesn't always find Ehrlichiosis in samples he gets, but something else about Smithers' blood caught his attention. Something else was going on there. He saw some sort of virus. This was out of his zone of expertise, so he turned to colleagues in neighboring departments for their take.
At that point, we spoke with the pathology department here at CDC. We said, you know, could you help us characterize this virus?
He walked over with several tubes of a culture.
Laura McMullen is a viral specialist with the CDC. She took the samples and ran a full genetic sequence on them. The process allows her to go through and compare millions of sequence possibilities, as opposed to picking one specific thing, one specific virus, and then looking for it.
By using this technology, they're not limiting themselves for what they're looking for, because they're indeed looking for anything.
McMullen says the CDC has only just started using this technology in the last few years. It's a huge bioinformatics process, and it takes several weeks. Back in St. Joe, as all of this was going on, Smithers and the other patient finally got better. Dr. Folk thinks this was in spite of any treatment they may have gotten, and that was unsettling to him. He hoped to learn more from the CDC, and he did. But the answer he got only raised more questions. That's because McMullen's test did find something, genetically unique, something totally new.
We then relayed this information to Dr. Nicholson that we were, you know, actually working with a brand new virus. And I think everyone got excited at that point.
McMullen says the virus probably came out of the U.S., meaning it wasn't brought over from another country, like West Niles or SARS. She and Nicholson say part of what's so exciting about the discovery is it marks the first time a new human virus has been found in the U.S. in 19 years.
You do feel, you know, that, oh, wow, this is cool.
The New England Journal of Medicine published their findings a few months ago. But what exactly is this new virus?
It's a flebovirus.
Yeah, so P-H-L-E-B-O-V-I-R-U-S.
Again, that's flebovirus.
Fleboviruses have been described from ticks, soft ticks and hard ticks, but not causing human illness on this side of the world.
It was originally found in phlebotomous flies or sand flies in Europe during World War II.
McMullen says there are more than 70 members of the flebovirus family. Ticks, mosquitoes, and sand flies often carry them. A few types can be transmitted to people and cause illnesses. The closest flebovirus relative to this new virus was recently identified in China and caused some fatalities. Dr. Nicholson cautions against making too much of a connection. This one in Missouri is still very different. But Nicholson says so much about this new virus is still a mystery. That's why since they identified it, he and others have begun conducting research on it outside the lab.
By understanding the ecology and knowing which ticks, knowing what time of year, knowing which animals, we may be able to put some preventive measures in place, and that's what we really want to do.
So last spring and summer, Nicholson and a team of researchers from the CDC and the state got together several times in areas around St. Joseph. That included near the homes of Smithers and that other patient.
We've got animal bloods, animal serum.
The group tested and tagged animals for the virus to figure out what carries it, how it's transmitted, and how widespread it is. Nicholson suspects the Lone Star tick, common in Missouri, is a likely source of the virus. So he and others gathered lots of ticks.
Well, I'm not sure the exact totals, but, you know, it's 5,000 or 6,000 the first trip. Second trip, a few more. Last trip, I'd say probably 30,000 or more.
30,000 ticks?
Ticks.
You collected 30,000 ticks?
Yes.
Nicholson says one area they targeted was near Larry Smithers' fence, where they think he got sick. They trapped the ticks by putting out buckets of dry ice. Dry ice emits carbon dioxide, which makes hungry ticks think a human or animal is nearby.
They become somewhat hypnotized by the by the gas, and they'll hang out in that area going, you know, looking for that host or hoping the host will come by and brush against it.
Researchers are now going through and processing those vials filled with ticks and animal samples. They've also been trying to find other patients at Heartland Hospital and a few other places who may have the virus. The Missouri Health Department has issued notices to doctors around the state, too. The virus doesn't appear to be as much of a public health burden as, say, West Nile virus, but Nicholson advises taking the same precautions as one would take for avoiding other tick diseases. That includes covering exposed skin, using repellents, and checking for ticks after being outside. Back at Heartland Hospital in St. Joseph, Dr. Folk, the infectious disease doctor, hopes to find out more about this new virus to better respond to future patients who might appear with it. But he and other hospital staff are also thrilled by the unexpected find and are proud to be part of it. In fact, the new virus is called Heartland virus. Dr. Folk wears a tie with Heartland virus written on it as he explains how he and the CDC came up with the name.
We talked about it some more and thought, well, Heartland virus would make sense because that's where the first two patients were identified, and also because we're in the middle of the Midwest, the Heartland part of the United States. So we thought it made sense. So that's why the name stuck.
As for Larry Smithers, patient zero in all of this, he tells me back at his place that he's a little less enthused about the whole thing. After all, he nearly died.
If it had went on past me, I'd have still been all right. I just don't. If it had never happened, it'd all been, you know, for the better, I think.
Smithers hopes others don't experience what he did, so he is glad researchers have been out to his land trying to learn more. And that research still continues. Nicholson says he and other researchers plan to come back this spring in hopes of better understanding what Heartland virus is all about. Reporting for KC Currents, I'm Alana Gordon.
And the name of that tune, by the way, is Beware of the Lone Star Tick. It's by Don Bickoff.
And you know, it's more than ticks making news in St. Joseph. Just outside of the city, in Gower, a group of monastic nuns have a best-selling album. This is KC Currents.
This is KC Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, Liberty Memorial got a new designation for the nation's World War I centennial. A fire chief worried that a serial arsonist seems to be at work in Lawrence. And a new era began for the Kansas City Chiefs. Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
Sports fans waited almost 12 hours after ESPN had reported it for the official word that former Philadelphia Eagles coach Andy Reid was now head coach of the Kansas City Chiefs. While Reid and Chiefs owner Clark Hunt reportedly worked out final contract details, there was no news release, though there was one announcing the Chiefs had fired general manager Scott Pioli. Finally, after 9 p.m., the Chiefs released what looked like a cell phone photo of Reid and Hunt, in which they appeared to be signing copies of what Associated Press said was a 5-year contract. They also announced there'd be a news conference on Monday and posted a video called Turning Point, Andy Reid at the Helm, on the Chiefs' website. It was also the week Congress passed a starter deal on avoiding the fiscal cliff, and area politicians weighed in on the legislation. Democratic Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill commented that it wasn't perfect, but it was a good first step. Republicans, including Senator Roy Blunt, predicted rough sledding with that.
Why would you give the president legislative authority just because President Obama says he'd like to have it?
Blunt said Republicans will refuse to raise the debt ceiling to pay the bills unless Democrats agree to bigger spending cuts. Transit activist Clay Chastain said the city council had 60 days to schedule his latest rail initiative for a public vote, or he would start a petition drive for a recall election for Mayor Sly James. Chastain emoted on the subject for TV9 cameras.
This mayor is to democracy what a chainsaw is the old-growth forest.
Later on the phone, he was less bombastic, but one might say confident.
I've never gotten that many signatures before. But on the other hand, I'm at my best when I'm challenged.
As Chastain stormed, the Kansas City Streetcar Authority held its first public meeting at the downtown public library to discuss finding an operator for a rail plan the council as well as the voters did approve. Mayor James chose not to even comment on Chastain's threat. The big announcement out of the mayor's office was that former Missouri U.S. Senator Kit Bond will become the city's new Washington lobbyist. Lawrence Fire Chief Mark Bradford said he believes that a serial arsonist is responsible for around 20 fires in multifamily dwellings in the south central part of that city and asked apartment managers and residents to keep an eye out for people hanging around who shouldn't be.
Anything that they can point out to us would probably provide us with some important information that we could follow up on.
The ATF has put out a $7,500 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the arsonist. Out in K-State country, the Department of Homeland Security officially took ownership of the proposed site for the National Bio and Agro Defense Facility. Senator Pat Roberts predicted construction would start before the end of the year, but Stephen Higgs, director of the Biosecurity Research Institute, said with controversies over safety and budgets,
it might not happen.
NBAF lab opponents include some ranchers, scientists, and Manhattan residents. And the U.S. Congress made Liberty Memorial the official headquarters for a commission that will plan events for the World War I centennial. It was a compromise step back from declaring the memorial the nation's official World War I monument because they believed one should be built in Washington, D.C. This is KCUR.
Christmas has come and gone, and for a lot of people, it's been another round of traditions and family reunions. But for a convent of nuns outside of St. Joseph, this year was a little different. The Benedictines of Mary released a CD of choral music, which reached number one on the Billboard music charts for traditional classical music. Alex Smith has this story of the world's least likely hit makers.
Just outside the town of Gower in northwest Missouri, a priory of about 20 nuns leads a simple life of contemplation. They maintain a small farm for their food, and they sew vestments for priests. As a traditional order, the Benedictines of Mary wear habits, fast, and practice penance, and they very rarely have contact with anyone in the outside world. They even observe silence for long periods while meditating or studying. But their quiet austerity is broken up 8 times a day when the nuns gather in their chapel to sing. Monica Fitzgibbons of De Montfort Music in Naples, Florida, explained by phone.
It's called Liturgy of the Hours. When they gather for their work of God, they call it, they go in and praise God 8 times per day. So the entire 150 psalms with their hymns are chanted throughout the week, and that is part of the original ancient rule. Some people have modified it, but they go with the original rule. So basically their life is one big song. I mean, I say this all the time, but I think really they must sing more than they actually speak.
The Benedictines of Mary never perform or even take part in public church services, but they have made a few do-it-yourself CDs of their music. Monica Fitzgibbons first heard one of these CDs in spring of 2012. She and her husband Kevin had both spent years working for big entertainment companies, but they'd recently left those jobs to start their own. Monica and Kevin were looking for candidates for the first release of their new record label when they fell in love with the music of the Benedictines of Mary. They contacted the nuns, who, as it turns out, were facing some pretty serious financial challenges.
They had been praying a novena to St. Therese for some sort of relief on the debt that they were incurring. And right towards the end, could even be at the very end of this novena, we sent them a letter. And so they reached out to us after receiving our letter and said, why don't you come and meet with us?
The Benedictines of Mary agreed to a record contract, and in October, Monica and Kevin Fitzgibbons returned to the convent, this time with recording equipment, an engineer, and a producer. They recorded the nuns singing chant, polyphony, hymns, and even an original song, a cappella, in the chapel. For the music industry professionals, recording nuns was a change of pace.
One thing that really amazed myself and the producer and engineer is that they ended up serving us. I mean, they made us meals, so there was never any diva behavior.
The three-day recording session was also a dramatic change for the nuns, but they still continued their daily routine in the chapel between takes.
Even during the recording, they continued this sort of rule of life of doing their psalms and their divine office 8 times per day. So it was kind of funny, actually, for the producer. We would end our session and take a break, and the sisters would all file back into the chapel to sing their appointed time of day, whatever the corresponding office would be, whether it was Compline or Matins or Lauds. They would go back in and sing these psalms, and the producer and engineer were going crazy. What? You should be resting your voice. What are you doing? And no, they were going to go back in and continue on with that, and they just felt that that would be a blessing to the project to stay faithful in that way, and it was.
By typical music industry standards, the CD, entitled Advent at Ephesus, was produced with lightning speed. It was recorded in early October of 2012 and released just a month and a half later. Unlike most recording artists, the Benedictines of Mary can't promote or do concerts, so Monica and Kevin used all their music industry experience and connections to promote the recording. It was released on November 19th, and a week later, the CD appeared as the number one seller on Billboard's traditional classical music charts, where it stayed through Christmas. While CD sales were probably boosted by the demand for holiday music and the novelty of the performers, Monica Fitzgibbons also believes the music has a unique beauty.
It's just a rare piece of art, and it's not all chant, it's not all polyphony. I mean, it's kind of a combination of some, you know, rich treasures throughout the ages. So you do have the chant, you have Latin, but they do have quite a bit in English. They have old French hymns, German. They're songs that have been around in the public domain, but they've sort of taken them and done their own arrangements. And then it's just so peaceful and tranquil that people have found when they've listened to it, it's just brought a peace, a calm. It's just something that they've really just enjoyed in that way.
The Advent at Ephesus CD has earned glowing reviews from classical music critics. It's received coverage from USA Today, The Washington Times, and All Things Considered. Over the holiday season, the Benedictines of Mary found themselves turning down performance requests from The Today Show and Jay Leno. But Monica Fitzgibbons says the nuns have been unchanged and unfazed by their success.
Well, it fazed them in the sense of they were grateful, but it didn't faze them in the sense of, you know, they thought they were special or, you know, awesome. They were just glad that somehow people were picking up on it and that they were enjoying their music. I'm definitely going to say they were surprised because they're not out there on the Today Show every day, you know, plugging away. But I guess in their way of life, nothing should surprise them.
The Benedictines of Mary are already planning a follow-up to Advent at Ephesus to be released by this summer. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
Well, once again, we thank you for tuning in to Casey Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the Casey Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kcurrents.
Casey Currents is produced by Sylvia with assistant producers Alex Smith and Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Zach Lewandowski. And theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
Welcome back, Sylvia.
Thank you.